1, 2, 3, 4.
How would the life of Jesus be told through the eyes of his mother? How can literature help us understand history and the nature of identity?
Born in Warsaw, Polish writer Maciej Hen is a jack of all trades. Graduating with a degree in cinematography from the film school in Łódź, he has since pursued projects in journalism, translation, and television. He has also published 4 novels to date, including According to Her and Solfatara. Both of these novels, in addition to Hen's other works, have earned him widespread literary recognition.
Maciej Hen, welcome to The Creative Process.
Good to see everybody.
So we're speaking today about your body of work and your novel, According to Her, which was your first book translated into English. You know, before you share a passage with our listeners, just to give them a little bit of background, According to Her has a quite intriguing premise because it's a book-length interview with Mariamne, the mother of God. And the novel is written in this very down-to-earth language of an old Jewish peasant from Galilee, reminiscing about the life of her son.
Okay, so I'll read. So Pilate, he read some verse without paying any attention to what was before and what came after, then demanded explanations from Yehuda. It says here, God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. That's right, Yehuda confirmed. So this God of yours is now a goddess? Oh no, your highness, Sicari disagreed lively. God of Israel, he argued, is not like Roman gods. They are, it seems, similar to people, just bigger and more beautiful. Is that correct? And our God is not like that. Truth is that no man has ever raised his eyes at him, even Moshe himself here. See for yourself. Pilate, slightly irritated, didn't let him change the subject. So what does it mean, then, in his own image? He asked in a resounding voice, as if drilling his soldiers. If all people are made in God's image, then the emperor surely is too. So why are you bothered by his portrait? Not a complete idiot, this bastard procurator, I shouted when Yehuda was laying this story to me. And what did you tell him?
True.
He had me at a loss, Sicari admitted. You see, Mariamne, am I a rabbi to be able to answer every question? But, well, I felt that the honor of Israel was resting on my shoulders. He smiled under his breath. No way I had to come up with something. So I told him this. A man makes an oil lamp. What makes it similar to the sun? The light. Of course, you can't compare the light of such lamp to sunlight, but both produce light. But apart from that, the sun is nothing like an oil lamp, right?
Well, okay, what of it? Pilate grumbled gloomily.
What I'm trying to say, I answered, is that we don't know in what way we are like God and to what extent. Surely much less than a lamp is like the sun. And probably, like with the lamp, the only thing that matters is the flame burning inside us and the light it produces, not the container, even if made of pure gold, not the wick. Even though that's where the flame comes from. Not even the oil itself, even though it fuels the flame. None of those things is in any way like the sun.
You know, it's a beautiful, a transcendent image. I love that so much. And actually relates to some of your other books. It's not the physical shell, you know, it's the energy inside. But you're just going back to your cultural background, growing up in a Jewish household in Poland, you've mentioned being immersed in a Christian tradition through European culture. How did this unique cultural perspective shape your decision to retell the story of Jesus from a Jewish viewpoint? And what challenges did you encounter in navigating this delicate balance?
Certainly has a lot to do with my background. But in fact, you know, all of my background when I was young was really European. That is more or less Greco-Christian. And of course, I was aware of some of my Jewish background, but very slightly. So after, in the 90s, when I was more or less 40 years old, I started to recover, to fill it up. And due to this Jewish education that I had been learning about Judaism from various rabbis, working for the Lauda Foundation. And I was also handing down what I had just learned. And this consolidated that new knowledge in my brain. To make it clear, I need to stress that I got interested with that not for spiritual reasons of any kind. I'm a sober person. I just saw that I owed it to many generations of my ancestors to come to know a little bit the heritage is in order to be able to preserve it and hand it down to my generation. So when I already knew something, I realized that many things I knew from the New Testament don't tally with my new knowledge. Like, for example, the issue of someone considered Messiah or just a prophet by some Jewish followers, but not acknowledged by most others. Should such a person be banned or punished? There was a very recent example at the time of Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, considered Messiah by his Hasidim. Were they rejected and condemned? No. All other Jews said they're simply wrong about that particular matter, with all respect. So I returned to the New Testament trying to figure out what the application followers had made up for reasons and what could be a genuine remain of something that really had happened or had been said and then transmitted from those who had really witnessed it to those who wrote it down a few decades later. So this reasoning led me to the idea of writing a realistic novel about how it really could have been. And who could be a better narrator of the true story of Jesus than his Jewish mother?
Indeed, we're all looking for a place that we can belong.
Yeah, so did I. So that was really my first book and my first literary idea, because, you know, I never thought of writing anything serious. This was the only moment when I was certain that I really need to write it. And I really see it even as some mission. And this way I became a writer.
That's really fascinating. So given, as you mentioned previously, that Europe understands itself to inherit this Greco-Christian spiritual and philosophical tradition, I was interested in what the special significance was to the fact that the listener is Greek.
Well, this is really very simple. And the reason is, again, realistic. Most of those who are called first Christians, that is, Paul's disciples, were Greek or at least totally Hellenized Jews. I have imagined that one of them could feel a need to know, to find out a little bit more about the man whom they were taught to worship. So let's assume he found his 100-year-old mother and asked her some questions. So that's why he is Greek, quite simply. Maybe he's just collecting material to write his own gospel, or maybe not.
That's interesting. You mentioned previously that this was your first book. Yes. And so particularly the style was really fascinating to me, especially since there were no quotations surrounding Mariamne's speech. And so you can't immediately tell if it's in the first person or the second person or if it's omniscient. And I was just wondering, what was the choice behind this?
Well, for me, it's a classical first person narration. Of course, there is a mute figure of this Greek person she speaks to. But we can only guess who it is from some of the passages of her monologue. Me, I like to compare it to an unedited recording from a dictaphone held close to the mouth of the interviewee, so we cannot hear the reporter himself. We only hear the interviewee's voice. Generally, I think we don't need the reporter. We just need her. And she comes out quite characteristic, especially in my intention. In fact, I wanted to show Mariamne as a very folk-style old lady, speaking in her colorful and blunt language of a simple old woman of natural intelligence and dry sense of humor. From the very beginning, I had a very clear vision of her personality, the way she reasons, the way she sees the world, the way she speaks, her Jewish hypersensitivities, her pride, her intelligence, her wit. And so I just did my best to keep it consistent, and I hope I succeeded with it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The first time that I started to read according to her, it wasn't intuitively apparent to me that she was the mother of God.
And so I was interested then afterwards how you incorporate often historical allusions or religious allusions in your texts. What do you make of the possibility that your readers, especially given your international following, may not catch on to these allusions? It seems like Mariamne in particular, she's very much someone who's legible as an old Jewish woman in the sense that she doesn't need to be an allusion in order for us to relate to her as a character.
I find many different questions in your single statements. Let me answer the one about the reader catching on. It's not a problem if the reader doesn't catch on to cultural identity as a Mother of God or Virgin Mary. To me, the later a reader catches on, the better. And what if they never do? That's good too. Provided that the story draws them in. Maybe that's even better. I don't know. What did you ask? Because now I forgot.
Yeah, it was really just a question about how Mariamne in particular, given that she is legible as this Jewish woman who, or at least felt more recognizable to me, because I don't have this incredibly fantastic background with religious and cult historical allusions. She just seemed like she was especially perfect for that role, being both elusive and not.
Well, thank you. This was the easiest part, you know, of my work. Yehoshua himself was much more difficult to shape because while showing him in a very realistic way, avoiding miracles, I didn't want anybody to feel that it's a satire, that I'm mocking at it. And I didn't want anybody to feel offense, you know. I just showed him as a man, but this is very, very delicate because I didn't want to show him as someone he wasn't certainly. So I had to leave some space for interpretation of this character. At the same time, he had to be quite clear to see. So I wanted him to be a strong, colorful character. So it's always an oxymoronic task that I took on myself.
Yes. And subsequently, you have written Solfatara, which I think is possibly your most well-known book, for which you won the Witold Gombrowicz Literary Prize. And it brings in a much larger tapestry. I mean, you're dealing with recreating the tumultuous atmosphere of 17th century Naples with the Neapolitan Revolt. And could you just share some of your research process for that book and how you balance the historical accuracy with the demands of a fictional narrative?
Let's start with the last part of your question. You see, there's very few things in the book that I made up because the sources are so rich that I had a very rich set to choose what to take and what to skip. You know, everything is so meticulously described by many historians of the time. So we know almost everything on the Neapolitan Revolt. And there's a lot of historical figures, minor figures I used. And the only thing that I had to do was to describe it in a colorful way, in a cinematic way, the way that reader could see that and hear that and smell that. You know, and also I've made up one main protagonist, but he isn't totally made up because the secret of his birth is something that's true. But after his birth, we don't know anything about him, so I invented it. And also there is one more character that is made up. And all the rest is authentic.
We should talk a little bit about Fortunato Petrelli's life. I didn't realize that the others were authentic because they're really vivid characters, but there's so many, and you've been compared to Cervantes in terms of this rich tapestry. But just talk a little bit about Fortunato, and then, of course, the novel's story within a story structure and why you chose that.
Mainly because I really love the masterpiece of this kind of literature and the manuscripts found in Saragossa by Jan Potocki. And I really was excited by the idea of trying to make something similar to it. It's not exactly similar, but I had a lot of fun trying to do it. And the other reason for that was that I wanted to tell the story about François de Nomé, the painter, who disappeared from history, from radars, in 1623. So he probably died after that year. And, you know, I wanted to show the Napoleon revolt. It's 1647. It's 24 years later. I knew that there should be different, let's say, time zones in my book, a lot of flashbacks. So I thought the better idea was to do it through a story within a story form.
And of course, you know, it centers in around Naples, but it takes in these other regions. Tell us about the journey that the story takes.
It all starts with the childhood of the main character, the narrator, but actually it starts in 1647 when he's 51, and now he moves back to his childhood, describes what's happening around him at the present time, and returns to his childhood and then youth and all of his journeys, meeting other people and listening to their stories. And as a child, he traveled from Rome to the north of Italy and then to Paris and to Metz in Lorraine, and then back to Venice, and then more or less the Naples region, Campania, and finally he settled in Naples as the owner of the local newspaper, one of the first in history.
It's so strange to imagine the first newspaper in history when we're in such an information-saturated age. Of all these characters, real people that Fortunato encounters, besides Fortunato himself, which was your most challenging or most interesting for you to write?
It's hard to answer, but I'll share one funny moment with you. I decided to have in my story Donna Sfeva d'Avalos. So I began to write about her. And after a few scenes where she participated, quite strongly participated, I discovered that she died like 4 years before my time of action. So she couldn't be there. So what to do? Should I give her another name, or should I make, I don't know, a ghost out of her? Or should I invent something else? And I invented something else. So she stayed in my story, but she's still kind of dead.
So given these stories within stories that are defining your narrative structurally, I'm wondering what you make of the fact that now, you know, in our cosmopolitan world, there's this increasing emphasis on shared human histories, identifications, and origins in general. Do you think that we lose something in these generalized accounts of our biological origins or historical origins?
Yes, I think we do lose something. It's never right to look at a human being only through general categories, through shared things, because every person is unique. So I think what is right is, at least from the literary point of view, is to keep balance between the unique and the shared things.
Yes. And on that subject of not seeing people or countries or individuals through general categories, you know, in your novel Segretario, which of course tells the story of a girl who assumes the name of a boy, it's a novel written in letters. What inspired you to write this? This has been more topical in recent years. How did you go about writing that book and intertwining the historical facts with the fictional narrative?
Of course, the girl is totally made up. And I must admit, I wasn't the first one who invented such a story. But I tried to tell the story the convincing way and the credible way, so that everybody believes that she is real. I wanted the reader to understand her way of thinking and find it quite close to his or her own, especially for the female readers, of course, because she's a girl. She's conscious that she's a girl. But in the world of men, being there as a man gives her a special perspective. It's a starting point of quite smart observations. She shares with her correspondent, the person that she addresses her letters with, what she sees, and tells her in a very girlish way how the men are like. You know what they say? You know what they think? You know how they react? And I'll tell you, I know it better than you can ever know.
Yeah, I can imagine if I was born into that era, which you bring to life very vividly, the Krakow Academy, and just a kind of lonely experience where she has this ambition, and that's the only way that she can achieve it. I mean, I don't know about you, Virginia, but if you imagined you were born during this time, you know, in the Middle Ages, could you consider disguising yourself as a boy?
Oh, I'm not sure. I don't think so. I mean, it's incredible.
It's not easy for everybody because of the type of looks. The girl that is in my book can afford it because of her looks. She can do it just because she has such a boyish figure. So it's quite easy to do for her. And also because she's very audacious and very intelligent. That's all I can say about it. You have to read the book to see what happens.
Right. So the way that you lay out each historical period and your attention to detail, it's reminiscent of the way that cinematically, I guess, period pieces are committed to bringing out all of the different details. And I was wondering if your cinematic background has informed the way that you lay out these settings narratively.
Yeah, quite frankly, people often tell me that my imagery, my way of telling stories seems cinematic to them. If it's really so, I'm happy. I hope they're right. I think it's a really great challenge and a privilege for an author to achieve such an effect that the reader actually sees what we are telling him or her and so gets emotional. Involved in the story the same way he or she feels while looking at the cinema screen, getting moved, or amused, driven to tears, or scared stiff. And every time I start something new, close friends of mine keep telling me, remember, try to make it as cinematic as we know you can, because after all, you used to study in the film school, didn't you? Well, I did, but I'm not sure if this quality of my writing has much to do with it. You see, if I say to myself, hey, try to write this bit a little more cinematically, it's not so easy. But whenever I just describe a scene the way I see it in my mind's eyes, if you let me use Shakespeare's expression, everything comes up ready to use. Props, colors, lighting, movements, close-ups, wide shots, sound effects, music, and dialogue. But I don't realize that. It's just writing. That's all.
Yes. And of course, you've been involved in some, you know, notable films as a cinematographer. And your father was a screenwriter and novelist as well. But you've been involved in documentaries. Just tell us about some of those experiences.
I made two documentaries myself already in this century. One was photographs about my dad, and the other was about an authentic lady who, during the World War II, was active as a spy by the so-called Home Army under the Nazi occupation first. And then when the Soviets came, she was spying for the Home Army still in the underground against the communist regime. So she spied for a few years and then she was arrested. And luckily, she only got 10 years of prison. And later, she was freed a little bit faster because of the amnesty. So she told me her story, and that story was quite interesting, not only from historical and political point of view, but also psychological, because she got entangled in romantic relationships with the Soviet officers she spied, and also with some Polish officers she spied too. And even when she was in prison, she had an affair with the commander of the prison.
Yes, it's a delightful story. And I see that you're drawn to some of these, going back to Secretario, intriguing imposters, whether fictional or real.
Yeah, that's really similar.
And just tell us about the documentary on your father. These are his photographs, because of course, he's a quite prominent literary figure as well. And I believe he's 100 years old now.
Yes. The story was just that I meet my father and we run his old photographs he's taken and photographs that were taken of him, and we talk about the story of his life looking at the photographs, and people liked it. People found it interesting.
So with this interest in personal histories and also imposters or potential imposters, this seems like a good place to start talking about Dutch for Intermediates. I was just interested in what role does Goethe's foul Faust play in your novel.
And though it's the main character is not an imposter. He's just a man who has lost the game of his life. He was 3 times married and all the marriages were miserable. And he's got children, 2 daughters that aren't very close to him. He's very, very poor. He's almost struggling to survive. And he is exploited by his so-called benefactor. The same way the peasants in the ancient Poland of 18th, 19th century were exploited by their noble masters. And so this man is contacted and they propose him to confirm his origins from a very distant forefather from whom he may inherit a not too big piece of land in Romania. So they send him in a journey through some of Ukraine and Romania to collect documents confirming that this is really his line of inheritance. But he is surprised by what he discovers during this journey. And for some magical reasons, he becomes young. He's not aware of this initially, but he really becomes younger than he was when he started. And, you know, at the end, he has to make an ethical choice. And he does, and I'm not going to tell you more.
Reflecting upon his panoramic descriptions and commitment to historical accuracy, I'm interested in the ways fact and fiction coalesce in Maciej Hen's storytelling. On the one hand, fiction is an imaginative construction, something invented and unreal, but it is also the vehicle through which narratives acquire the texture of reality. As Catherine Gallagher indicates, the more details assigned to characters and settings, that is, the more fictional narratives become, we as readers are increasingly immersed within the world of the narration. We feel, like Hen suggests, that we can realistically see, smell, and taste. Facts alone, isolated from narratives, do not elicit these kinds of experiences. When we hold facts before our eyes, they confront us as fixed objects, ones that are separate from us and our perceptual capacities. We cannot touch them, and so they remain abstract and immutable, beyond reproach, much less modification. Paradoxically then, fiction implies real experience while facts merely stand before us as mute and as obtuse as rocks, claiming foundational statuses without seeming qualification. The funny thing is that facts are not infallible, nor are they outside the realm of experience. Instead, they are fickle and capricious, deriving from human perspectives in, never beyond, the experiential landscapes of our lives. We can never get beyond our subjective points of view, and neither do our facts, much as they may try. This is perhaps most apparent in our historical archive, where what remains is only ever a partial account of events. Take, for instance, the recent controversy in Belgium, where King Leopold's colonial atrocities were scrubbed out of public records, or accounts of the Middle Passage that reduced enslaved individuals to mere numeric quantities. By entitling such facts to objectivity, we don't just stray from real truths, but obliterate the possibility of ever recovering them. Instead, in Hen's work, I see an attempt to negotiate the fiction in our facts, the ways these fail us, the origin stories they seem to obscure and refute. But Hen is not just showing us the ways that mere factual accounts impoverish history as an aesthetic experience. Rather, by situating us narratively within historical moments, he opens up a space for dialogic contestation, for human agency. When we touch, smell, and hear the sounds of revolt, or a girl's attempt to navigate a male-dominated world, we likewise acquire the power to identify narrative gaps in our archive, places where violence lacks expression, where generalized accounts eclipse individual lives. Hen, along with Nietzsche, along with Sadia Hartman, and so many others, shows us that history is not a project tasked to historians alone, but one for creators, the storytellers willing to look back and lay out the fictions of fact.
And you've spoken about your varied career as a cinematographer and documentary maker, journalist, of course, translator, and also you dabbled in music as a young man. And in your recent book, The Beatles in Poland, you revisit music in a nonfiction way. What drew you to that subject?
The Beatles in Poland. You know, some people suggested that I should write a book like this because they know me as an expert of the Beatles. And I became an expert of the Beatles slowly, step by step, but it started very strongly when I was a teenager, that is in the second half of the 60s of the 20th century. You know, for me, that was an artistic discovery. The Beatles and generally the rock music, but the Beatles especially, because they're simply the greatest of all. And they're not just rock, they're a phenomenon of the 20th century, just like Charles Chaplin and Picasso. This is what I keep repeating. You know, what's more important to us is that the Beatles really passed the test of time quite safely, and they're still important to everybody who has his ears to listen.
Yeah, it's amazing they can speak across cultures. In fact, we just recently had John Lennon's son, Julian Lennon, on our show, and he kind of channels his voice as well in his own music, kind of eerily, I would say. But yeah, there's this sense of joy and optimism in the music. And then the fact, I mean, I'm not an expert like you on the Beatles, but the fact that the production quality isn't as synthetic as we hear now. But I think that part of that resonance is the good, strong lyrics and, you know, authentic voice. Mm-hmm. So this comes to, you know, as you think about the future and our new technologies and AI and the way this is changing the way we communicate with each other and our own imaginations, what are your reflections on that and how it's changing the role of storytellers?
Yes, people are worried about it. Me, I think for the moment, the AI is not really a threat. It can be helpful, but there is a tendency to overuse it, but it will pass. We can use it to make something really human, not digital automatic. Just use it as people in the 20th century used the recording technique for the first time to give music back to the audience in the 19th century. The only way to listen to the music was to listen to it live. That was a revolution, and one could say, well, it's not a music, it's just a record. The music is what we knew before, live. Yes, well, we need to adopt new techniques, new possibilities, but we have to use them for our human aims to get really human results.
Indeed, to serve the purposes of humans and not those of the technologists. I'm wondering about, you know, you're also a translator. And so what has translation taught you about writing?
In a sense, it's an exercise, because when reading someone writing in English, which is not your native language, you should be able to understand what is special in his style or in the style some of his characters speak, or where is the hidden wit in some sentences that look quite normal. So when you do understand it and you find a way to produce an equivalent in your own language, you just trained in working with language and with telling the story and making images out of words and everything, you know. So probably it's a good practice. But of course, writers who can write without that, just starting to write in their own language, not practicing with some product I translate. So probably it did me good, but was that necessary? I'm not sure.
And, you know, speaking, you just talk about that special character, and I'm wondering what you feel is a special character of Polish literature and the arts.
Generally, Polish intellectuals, including artists, writers, and everybody, are still in that never-ending argument on Polish history on many levels, in terms of why did Poland lose its independence after being some kind of empire, and what were the injustices in historical Poland, the traumas of World War II, and what was before the World War II, and the communist period. It's a topic of an argument. And, you know, this is really present in Polish culture, in creativity, in literature. On the other hand, the contemporary Polish literature is very much form-oriented, not so much content-oriented, except for some topics like peasant background of the society, discussing injustices the peasant class had suffered, and that's it. But Generally, the present Polish literature, there is a race of experiment to be observed. And quite frankly, I try to be beyond all of that because I'm a content-oriented type of a writer. But of course, the language issues are as important for me too, but not dominant. I think, anyway, the content is the most important thing.
Yes, and those human stories. And you mentioned there the Second World War, and we should mention your experiences of your father and your family during the Second World War.
Okay, I can tell you the story of my parents. They both lost most of their families during the World War II, and they survived because they were quick enough to escape to the East, where there was no paradise either, but at least there was a chance to survive. My father lost his father, one of his sisters, the sister's husband, and his brother. But the brother disappeared in Soviet Union. Nobody knows how. But the others were murdered by Nazis. And as for my mother, she lost almost everybody. She had 6 siblings. She managed only to take one of her sisters while evacuating to the East. So 5 of her siblings, both parents, they all died in the death camp in Belzec.
Yes, well, and so resilient were they, and that they passed on that to you and your rich imagination and the importance of finding beauty and joy in the world at the same time as remembering history and bearing witness. So as you think about the future and education and the importance of art and knowing history, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
That's a really difficult question. I would like them to know and preserve everything, really. But, you know, I would recommend them to explore things that pass the test of time. And although it's never certain what passes, but at least Shakespeare is something certain, isn't it? And things like that. I would like to encourage them to explore classics and younger classics, as much of the contemporary they are able to.
Yes, one eye in the past and one eye in the future. Thank you, Maciej Hen, for inviting us into your imaginative world and for inviting us to examine the origins of faith, the nature of identity, and bearing witness to our collective histories and memories so that we might have a better understanding of our presence. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you both, Mia and you, Virginia, and everybody listening.
The creative process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Virginia Moschetti. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.